All right. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Reptile Ramblings. I'm your host, Nate Truex, as always, joined by my eloquent host, Mr. Bryant McDowell.
Hey, Ramblers.
And today we have a special guest, Dr. James Emerson, Director of Undergraduate Research of Wildlife Biology at Texas State University. James, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So we got to, get our little maintenance out of the way. We have to give a shout out to our sponsor. So our sponsor, as always, is Serpentine Expeditions. That's the Embryolins Company and high-quality reptile herp tours all over the globe. So you guys should definitely check that out whenever you get a chance to. And when you do go to check out, make sure to use code CK25 to get $100 off of your reservation. You know, $100, that goes a long way. That could upgrade your seat from barely any leg room to a tiny bit of leg room. So be sure to do that. Like I said, code CK25 at checkout, and link and code will be in the description below.
Yeah. Again, as always, can't hype up Ian and his crew enough. They go above and beyond when it comes to scouting out areas. Obviously, herps is the main focal points, but not just herps, just overall biodiversity and quality time while being in that kind of, in biodiversity. So you won't go wrong with this tour company.
But before we get into the actual interview, Bryant, I have a little news.
Please.
I got a package the other day. Do you want to know what it was?
Not another snake.
No.
Book. Is it the book? The tome. Dun, dun, dun. Yep.
Dieter finished it, so got my copy. And been flipping
good
through
deal.
It. And he's right, it is like a solid, like 350-some pages of content, plus glossary and appendices. Has lists all like the different wildlife agencies and state agencies you should get in contact with if you want to do things the correct, right, and legal way, so...
Quality stuff, man. Yeah. Again, can't talk enough about Dieter as well, from our first interactions at CrocFest in June. What an awesome down-to-earth guy and real knowledgeable especially take it from Nate. Real knowledgeable when it comes to crocodilians in captivity.
And also features some photos from yours truly, so.
Okay. Okay, Mr. Publishing.
A little humble brag.
Yeah. Right. Slight.
So, let's dive into the meat of today's episode. Dr. James Emerson, welcome all aboard. Do you mind telling us a little bit about yourself, how you first got into reptiles, what kind of led you up to where you are now, and what you currently do?
Yeah, absolutely. Once again, thanks for having me. My kind of herpetological origin story starts like many others. It's just one of those things that most of us were drawn to from a very young age, and often we don't know exactly why. So none of my family was really into herps that much. And so, in fact, I was raised by my grandparents. My grandma was deathly afraid of snakes, much less rattlesnakes, which most of my work to this point has been on. And so, yeah, but even though they weren't herp people, so to speak, they could see my interest in it, and they never suppressed that interest or told me that I was pursuing something that wasn't worthwhile or anything like that. So from that perspective, I always had like the support of family and stuff like that. And so, but yeah, from an early age, it was always either going to be kind of herps or sharks. I was raised in the Texas Panhandle, not many sharks up there. So herps it was.
I mean, you don't know, tiger sharks, I think it probably go up the Rio Grande pretty far, right?
Yeah, so the reservoir up there is pretty salty. I'm sure some bull sharks could hang around there. But yeah, so That's kind of the quick view of how it started.
I don't mean to cut in, James, but did you also do some fossil hunting? Just because you mentioned sharks and, Western Interior Seaway. I mean, you're kind of.
Yeah, I haven't done much of it. As a kid, I was always interested in it. So as we'd go on like family trips and stuff, we would stop at all the natural history museums and stuff like that. But in terms of actually getting into fossil hunting, when I had kind of the knowledge behind me to know how to fossil hunt, I also got like super busy with like what I'm doing now. So there's just tough to find time to balance everything.
Sure. I guess the reason I bring it up is it's not always commonly associated, but if you like herbs, you probably like dinosaurs back in the day. So, yeah.
Yeah, for sure, very much. Yeah, it was kind of, seeing those dinosaurs at the museum, and then, of course, a lot of us as kids might be dating myself a little bit, but Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, stuff like that,
Oh,
always
geez, classic.
Land Before Time, always got me excited into the Saurian world, if we will.
Nice. Awesome. So I guess maybe try to bring us full circle to your position today and where it stands and kind of some of the projects and maybe trips you've done. Just kind of
Yeah, so to start off with, like, even though I had like family support in herp stuff when I was finishing high school and trying to pick a path in college, I was just like, there's no really clear laid out path to success to work with reptiles and these things that I'm interested in. So I was like, I'll try more practical things and, make a normal living, and then I can, keep herps or whatever on the side. That didn't really work out for me, so I wasn't the best student when I wasn't like super engaged. And so I took some time off, and then I didn't even realize that there was like this whole formal field of wildlife biology, and found out, and after a year and a half or so off, went back to finish my undergrad in wildlife biology. And getting a PhD wasn't exactly a well planned out kind of event. I just kind of chased opportunities as they showed up. And then 2020 rolled around and I was defending my dissertation. And then I was like, guess it's time to get a real job. So started throwing applications out there, and everything worked out with Texas State. And so I taught a little bit of like adjunct at community colleges before I got the job at Texas State. So I was hired here in August of 2022 as the undergraduate wildlife biology program director, as Nate mentioned in the beginning. And yeah, so started teaching a bunch of cool classes. I teach like wildlife management, techniques important for wildlife management, natural history of the vertebrates, mammalogy, and herpetology. And
Well, kind of in short, you hit the lottery because the viewers will know this. Anything under the genre of biology and especially like field biology and all that is, those are tough occupations to get into because it's so saturated and very competitive. So kudos to you to where you are today. That's awesome.
For sure.
I guess harking back, what were some of the first opportunities like you were alluding to that you kind of jumped on board with.
Yeah, so since I had that gap from my initial kind of ventures into college, like when I went back for wildlife biology, I was a little bit unprepared in the sense that I didn't know exactly how much effort it took outside of the classroom in this discipline. And so, like, senior year rolled around and it was just like, oh, what do I do now? And so, it was basically just like kind of reaching out and begging other grad students for opportunities so I could go out in the field and help them and get experience that way. And then it kind of rolled into me becoming a master's student. And so for my master's, I looked at, I worked in the northeastern Texas Panhandle along the Canadian River, looking at the influence of habitat type on various diversity metrics of the snake community up there. And so put out snake traps and tried to see how the communities differed between like sandsage prairie and wet meadow habitat. Didn't exactly work out as planned because during the 3 years that I collected data, there were the driest year on record up there, and the other two were like top 10 driest on record. So basically, wet meadows weren't wet, so there are not many snakes down there.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, still quality data to have, but obviously maybe not the exact result you're looking for.
Right. And it's so often the story when you learn how to do field research and stuff, it's basically just banging your head at the wall against a wall until you kind of make a breakthrough somewhere.
Till
But
something
yeah, the
sticks. Yeah.
go ahead, sorry.
No, that's like till something sticks is kind of what you mean. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, because something, it's Murphy's Law. If something can go wrong in the field, it's going to go wrong. And so, but
That's
yeah,
just
and
not
so
in the
then,
field.
Mm.
but yeah, and so then I kind of, I did a summer working in the South Texas thorn scrub, just starting a research project to examine the impacts of mineral development on the herp community on a property where there were at the time four state threatened herp species. And so got that up and running and then transitioned in late 2013 to my PhD at UTEP, where I worked on the behavioral ecology of eastern black-tailed rattlesnakes in the Chihuahuan Desert.
Oh, sweet. Yeah, I mean that's definitely an underrated quote for sure. I guess maybe if you can dive into that project a little bit.
Yeah, and so it was a fun project to work on. Like, when I say UTEP, for those who are unaware, that's University of Texas at El Paso, and they basically own a research station in the northern Chihuahuan Desert, or own a mountain range in the northern Chihuahuan Desert that serves as their research station, the Indio Mountains Research Station. And so I got to spend a few years out there, had a couple of different components of my research. The basis of it was doing radio telemetry because right before I started in 2012, Crotalus ornatus was just revalidated as a valid taxon, and so split apart from Crotalus melosus, the northern black-tailed rattlesnake. And so basically, we have very little information on this species west of the con or east of the Continental Divide. And so that meant that we knew nothing about this revalidated species. So basically, with telemetry, the initial goals were to look at, habitat use and selection, microhabitat use and selection, movement patterns and space use. And so radio telemetry to estimate home range sizes, core use areas, and see what habitats they were selecting for in the Chihuahuan Desert. And then I also had a lab-based experimental component where if I had some pregnant females, I'd pull them into captivity for them to give birth, and then I'd run the young through a series of feeding trials to determine innate feeding preference for the species. And so, super fun experiments to do. And so, yeah, I really enjoyed my time at UTEP working on it.
Well, that's a lot to unpack. So, I mean, I guess starting off with what did you find with the neonates? You know, were they rodent eaters off the bat, or what
Or
was
were they
kind of
able to
like
say
their
more
phase
like
selection?
lizard eaters, like a lot of small
Yeah.
and juvenile snakes?
Yeah, so it was really interesting because, and so when you're doing this stuff in a university setting, you have to deal with IACUC permitting, which is just institutional animal care and use committees. And so we actually had some hangups in the permitting process. And so I ended up like getting provisionally approved to acquire the neonates, but I couldn't run the trials until we had to jump through this series of hoops to get fully approved. In short, they didn't like the, you know, we had somebody on the IACUC committee that was more like towards the animal rights side of things, which is a little
Sure.
iffy. So they were just, and since we were doing experimental trials, we wanted to keep everything in like sterile situations to avoid any exposure to, you know, stimuli that might influence feeding preference. And so we're going like, you know, basic sanitary plastic hides, paper towels, water dish, heat source, like simple sterile setups. And they didn't really like that at the beginning. And so we kind of had to provide all these justifications for it. It actually ended up being pretty cool because that meant that I had these neonates for almost 2 years in
Oh, wow.
captivity, and they had been fed, you know, your standard lab mice for the whole period of time. That ended up being really cool because when everything got approved and I was able to conduct my trials, they hated lab mice. And so, even though this was
Oh.
the only food that they knew, they overwhelmingly preferred native small mammals. There was a little bit of preference for earless lizards. But number one was Katydid intermedius, which is the rock pocket mouse, so a small heterobiid rodent in the Chihuahuan Desert. And number two was Merriam's kangaroo rat, so a big heterobiid rodent in the Chihuahuan Desert. And then it was the greater earless lizard. But it was really cool that you can really see that, at least with eastern black-tailed rattlesnakes, even though they would eat those lab mice, they didn't really want to set up ambush on any scent cues of lab mice.
That's an interesting potential impact on, like, say, herpetoculture. Like you say, someone did that with, say, I don't know, corn snakes or something like that. See how that what their changed diet would be, what their preferred diet would be. So, but
And then,
go ahead.
oh, and then also, like, because I saw that kind of tertiary spike at the earless lizards, I initially ran my trials in like diurnal settings. And so then I reran them, but under nocturnal conditions to see if they wanted to feed on different things during the daytime lizards versus nighttime. And, got no differences in that. So they're just finding a scent that they like and they set up ambush.
Okay.
Awesome.
And
I get my bad, Nate. I would say maybe just to give the listeners a bit of pretext, maybe go over a little bit of the actual species, you know, or not as, you know, what kind of the general overview of that species.
yeah, so it's kind of medium sized, I guess. Some would call it montane, others would consider it more submontane rattlesnake species of the desert. And so some would consider it submontane because they have a broad ecological range. And so you can find them in lowland areas, but they tend to be associated with rocky stuff. And with the radio telemetry stuff, We did find overwhelming habitat selection for rocky slope and arroyo habitats and general avoidance of like alluvial flat habitat, so like creosote flats and stuff like that. And so they tend to be more of a low kind of foothills montane species. So that's why some people consider them submontane.
I mean, do you think that's because they live in Sabbatri with Aatrox as well? And, Aatrox is more of that generalist, but also low lying. And then, Nate pulled up a gorgeous example of one of these critters. They're real pretty rustic species. And that, one thing about the blacktails, and it is kind of synonymous with almost all the blacktails. They all have these big, boofy heads, even for like a rattlesnake. Proportionally, you have big heads.
And so on the site, we actually have pretty solid telemetry data for all three of the sympatric rattlesnake species, Western Diamondbacks, Aatrox, Ornatus, of course, and then rock rattlesnakes, Lepidus. And there, Aatrox is more of the lowland species. Blacktails are kind of montane to submontane, and then rock rattlesnakes are kind of arroyo species. And so there seems to, at least anecdotally, we haven't crunched the numbers or anything, even though we have the data, we could do that. Anecdotally, it seems like they have their ways of partitioning resources to avoid direct competition. And yeah, as the indirect competition, the big generalist Aatrox is probably going to outcompete, Ornatus. And so, because a lot of those creosote flats with the dense vegetation and stuff are going to be where the highest, small mammal densities are.
I'm curious, has there ever been hybrids of Aatrox and Ornatus?
I haven't heard of Aatrox ornatus hybrids. Let's see. I mean, there's the standard Viridis scutulatus hybrids, the Aatrox porridus hybrids. There have been a couple found in kind of northern Texas.
I say this because it seems like Aatrox is kind of like the ball python
Right.
of crows. I don't want to put any slight on ball pythons, but we all know what people have done with them.
Yeah, there's so many dark and terrible things that have happened with ball pythons. I was gonna make the joke when you first described that, kind of clinical setup, the paper towels, water bowl, sterile setup. I was like, oh yeah, that's the ball python breeder's expensive suite, right?
No, and that's one of the things, one of the reasons that I don't keep animals anymore is just because I don't have the time to put into them what I think they deserve. And so because I'm away doing research and stuff like that, and so if I ever get back into it, I want to be able to do it correctly for the animals.
But speaking on that, croats are one of the ones that, they are a lower maintenance kind of critter. And in Texas, I think it's a permitting system, or I mean, it depends on the ordinances and whatnot, but you can pick your
Yeah,
fight.
for exotics, it's a permit. For natives, it's like as long as you have a, hunting license, you're good to go.
So, I was you mentioned your telemetry tracking study. Part of it was looking at habitat and microhabitat usage. And did you notice any particular preferences that Ornatus showed for between different habitats and microhabitats?
Yeah, so for habitat on the research station, we had five broad scale habitat categories. And so we had the alluvial flats, which are the creosote flats. So flat areas, gravel substrate, tend to be widely dispersed vegetation dominated by creosote with some kind of succulents and bunch grasses mixed in. Then we had alluvial slopes, which are just the gentle slopes following that same general vegetative pattern. And then we had alluvial rocky slopes, which are as you begin to transition up the mountains. These are exposed areas of bedrock that are covered in like a fine gravel. You start to get more of like the acacia tree species. I know the genus for like US acacia has since changed, but I still use acacia. So you start to get more heterogeneity in terms of like fissure habitat, so like crevices, and then more heterogeneity in like woody vegetation. Rocky slopes are going to be kind of those exposed rim rock areas, so highly fissured, a lot of crevices, those rock loving cactus succulent species. And then we have arroyos, which are kind of the small canyons that drain the mountains. So when the monsoon rains hit, it's going to take the water eventually down to the Rio Grande. But arroyos tend to be flanked by areas of a lot of rock. And because they do drain the rain, they hold higher soil moisture and have these dense bands of vegetation along the sides. And so for that, we saw that ornatus are going to prefer or are going to select for rocky slope habitat. So they like those crevices, you know, where they can seek refuge from the harsh desert conditions. And they like arroyos. And so those areas with the dense bands of vegetation that harbor the most small mammal diversity on the property, which all three of the rattlesnake species had selection for arroyos. But then they would normally have selection for one other habitat, which was, you know, different than the other two.
Yeah, I mean those arroyos are kind of like your hunting honey holes, you know, they're
Exactly.
pretty well endeared. When it comes to, oh crap, I lost it. I had the question and I lost it. Take it away,
Welcome
Nate.
to the
Lost
club.
it.
Well, I can dive into the micro habitat stuff to kind of build upon the habitat
Yeah,
stuff.
so if you notice in like they like say under logs or for like maybe under large rocks or in fissures or anything like that.
I got it. I was going to mention, like, what was their activity pattern since you did do this telemetry study?
Yeah, so generally we have several different ways of looking at activity patterns. And so in terms of raw movement, just like you would expect based on data with other rattlesnakes, males move a lot more. They use a lot more space than females do. Then in terms of seasonal movement, we actually saw only 1 month of significant difference in movement, and that was males in August, because that's peak monsoon season, and that's when the males become amorous and start chasing their ladies around. And so their movement really peaked in August. We saw a peak that was approaching significance, but not significant in June with females, which biologically, that one's pretty interesting because for those listeners familiar with the Chihuahuan Desert, June is the most miserable month out there. So June is hot, dry. Like I got my hottest ground temperatures in June, which would sometimes be up to over 79 degrees Celsius, which is, you know, probably like 150,
Wow.
160 degrees Fahrenheit. So,
Low, so,
crazy hot.
so low end monitor basking spot.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, and so the hypothesis behind this would be that females are moving ahead of the monsoonal arrival to lay down these rapid-based pheromone trails so that when males start moving in the monsoon season, they can find them. And so that we didn't do any kind of testing of female scent trail or trail laying down or anything like that, but that would be what we think's going on based on that, because those males have to have a way to find the females. But yeah, any other questions on the movement patterns?
So I'm curious. So basically, with their seasonal activity pattern, obviously there'd be this big jump in August, and then would you say like around now, kind of everything would be kind of shut down? Because
It was
I'm not
variable.
familiar with the climate. I don't know. Does it get particularly cold in the northern Chihuahua desert?
It can, but it's mainly moisture driven, so it just dries out by kind of early to late November. But that being said, and as a desert, like it does cool off at night quickly. And so you might get, December days that are 78, 79 degrees Fahrenheit, but then it's like 38, 42 degrees at night, just because, all that stuff just all that heat just leaves back out into the atmosphere.
Like that lack of moisture, like you were saying.
Yeah, because there's no like cloud barrier to kind of trap that heat in, like we get down here in more South Texas.
Well, I'm curious, when doing that first project, were there other spoils of glory when out in the field? Like, I guess some things that are cherished are what, Bogart Ophis, or maybe you can touch along what are some other herbs from that project that you down.
And so before I dive into that, I will say, like, back to like the winter ink stuff, like it was variable. So I had one snake that didn't go down until like mid-December, and
Oh,
then
really?
most of my snakes though would go down like right around Thanksgiving, so like right around now. But
Why do
yeah,
you think
so
the one straggler? What was going on with that one?
I have no idea, because he was also out and about, like back down in his arroyo in ambush posture like February 8th. And so basically he just took like a 6 week nap and was like ready to go. And so
You
I think
just
it's
had
just
the
end of it.
one that the cold didn't bother him anyways, I guess, but
Yeah, it's just individual variation. And so as long as they're, not dropping below freezing where they experience cell death and stuff like that, if it so drives them, they can figure out a way to make it work. And so but yeah, so other spoils, I guess the biggest, you mentioned Bogart Ophis. Bogart Ophis is probably the it's among the top three most common kind of colubrids on the property, and so see a lot of those.
Oh, awesome.
Sounds like our
Like
new
if you
herping spot, right?
Like if you spent like any time out on any given night, like it was rare that you didn't find a Bogart Ophis, in many, if there is adequate moisture and stuff like that. So for the property, the biggest kind of gem, which led to a side project that myself and another PhD student, the one who was tracking Aatrox, looked at, was gray-banded kingsnakes. And so in the Indio Mountains, prior to my arrival there, there had only been two documented gray-banded kingsnakes found, and they were both found in 1997. August 2015, I found what would be my lifer gray-banded kingsnake and third one for the property. And so that was an awesome experience. But then we So we started compiling these radio telemetry data sets on the Croats. We also had some radio telemetry data on Lepidus, but it was done a few years before we were doing it. So in order for comparison, we're like, it'll be nice to get some small transmitters and get some concurrent Lepidus data. We put out two Lepidus with radio transmitters late in the year. They came out the following spring, and both of them immediately got hammered by badgers. So we didn't get any
What
data
happened? They
on
were
it.
predated on? Is that what you said?
Yeah, just eaten by badgers. Based on sign at the area, it looked like badgers.
Bummer, bummer.
Yeah. And so then we were just like, well, we don't want to keep wasting these transmitters if these stupid rock rattlesnakes are just going to get eaten by badgers. And in June, we ended up finding another big female Alterna. And so we were like, oh, well, we have these. She's big enough. We have these little transmitters. If we can get them thrown on our permit real quick, we can throw a transmitter out in Alterna and see what happens. And so, yeah, we got the state approval to do telemetry of Alterna. And so we got a transmitter out in her. And then the following year, I found another male that was big enough for another transmitter. So we got another transmitter out in Alterna. And so we only had two snakes, a male and a female. But since nobody had radio tracked Alterna, we went ahead and published that paper just to kind of show people that, yeah, there's secretive snakes and stuff, and but it can be done. And with as popular as they are, we really need to, look more into their biology to see if, we have any issues with like collecting and population effects and stuff like that. And so, but it was really cool to track them because they're very different in the wild than they are in captivity to me. And
What do
so it
you
was
mean by
really
that?
cool. So anybody who's kept an Alterna in captivity, they kind of, when they eat, they're just kind of these goofy, like clumsy, slow things. Like sometimes they eat, sometimes they don't. And you're just kind of like, oh, how do these things even survive? But when you see them foraging in the wild, it's crazy because they're just like, they're foraging almost like you'd think a racer or a coach whip. They're just like quickly moving, and they're just like scent probing all these burrows under rocks and then aside on to the next. And they're just like moving with intent and quickly. And so what we found with them is that they hardly ever move. So their movement frequencies are incredibly low, but when they move, they go. And so like our female Alterna had like bigger home range sizes than any of Dominic's Aatrox that he was tracking. So
Really?
she was moving, like when she moved, she would move like, hundreds of meters. But then when she wasn't moving, she was just, in the same rock pile. We also got cool stuff where we could tell by following them with their radio transmitters that they moved a lot underground. And so they would be in these networks of rock slides. And you could almost like follow them paralleling the rock slide as the signal is moving through it. So that they're moving underneath that. And then also our female, when she was overwintering, we got a snow at Indio, which like once a year or so, like you asked about the cold, like they'll get a dusting of snow, but nothing major. And so when it snowed, she actually moved underground from a high area to a low area. So we think she was moving down to, where the snow melt moisture went to in order to get a little bit of hydration during the dry winter. And so it was cool stuff with alternate just because, we had no idea what we were going to see with those since nobody had ever done it before.
Yeah, it's really
What's that?
interesting behavior of just sit for finding a place you like for long period of time, but when you do decide to move, you just move. That's but do you notice any particular habitats or areas that they seem to be more prone to moving through, or I say, do they seem to have some sort of habitat preference, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, so when they were hunkered down, like not moving, so most of the time they were primarily in like rock slides, so like talus slides. When they moved and foraged, though, they kind of preferred like the grassy, rocky hilltops. And so they would be moving between bunch grasses and vegetation and stuff like that. But it is highly kind of condition dependent. So actually, I was tracking the male one day, and when we tracked them, we would try to get a daytime location so we could, in theory, find refugia. And then we would try to go back and track them after dark so we could catch them moving, hopefully. I went during it was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon in an August day. And the male was just out. Like we'd had like a rainstorm the morning, but it was still like ground temperatures were like 42 degrees Celsius. So over 100 degrees. But the male was out like foraging. He was doing that same like pattern, like just moving, scent probing, moving, scent probing. And then so the next morning I went to find him and he was just coiled with, you could just see a few scale rows visible under Letchagia. So humidity was high enough, so he just took refuge on the surface because he was, trying to eat or whatever. But most of the time when they were moving, it was kind of these rocky, grassy hilltops. And when they were concealed, it was like talus slopes.
Okay, and follow up on that, do they seem to have any sort of environmental preference, like I said, like after a rain shower, or did that sort of like difference in humidity levels not really impact their frequency of movement?
Movement seemed to be heavily impacted by moisture availability. So, humidity spikes, they wouldn't leave their overwintering sites until we got the first rains of the year. So, very tied to humidity rates, which is not surprising for, the smooth-scaled species that have higher evaporative water loss rates.
I'm curious, did they show site fidelity? 'Cause since you said they when they move, they do go for quite a bit, but I guess for overwintering sites or other kinds of refugia, did you see site fidelity? That's kind of what I'm getting
Yeah,
at.
they definitely had defined home ranges. And so like the female was basically like an entire canyon, and she would kind of do a loop around the canyon, and then winter would show up and she'd go back to the same kind of hillside. The male, like even during the active season, he would take these short term, like long distance trips, like away from his rock slide, but always within, a week or two, he'd come back to the same rock slide. And that's which is the rock slide I found him in. And he'd be at varying levels within the rock slide, but he'd always come back to it. Hopefully, he's
That's
still
so
hanging out
cool.
in there somewhere.
That's so cool. I suppose, you touched on Bogart office, but I'm curious that, I mean, I guess maybe dive in a little bit on that just because that's kind of a favorite of Nate's and I's. I'm curious, have you done any work on them or just, I guess, anecdotal work?
Yeah, so most of my information on Bogartophis is anecdotal, just kind of my experiences in the field. We would just, standard mark and measure and hopefully recapture at a later point in time. But with snakes, recapture rates are notoriously low unless you are doing something like radio telemetry. But there was a student before us who did his master's on radio telemetry with Bogertophus, and he is back there now working on his PhD, but I think he's working on rattlesnake stuff for his PhD there. Of course, he always has that affinity towards Bogertophus because of that. But I mean, Bogertophus, like, what's not to like about him? You know, that they're big heads, they're bug eyes, they're kind of like big versions of Alterna in terms of body shape and stuff. And then, like, just as far as snakes go, they're it's hard to think of to find another wild snake that's more of a sweetheart than Bogertophus. Like, it's very rare that they just like lash out and musk and bite like most other wild snake species. Like, they just like you pick them up and they're just like, okay, I'm cool with it. Like,
I was gonna say, I think their patterning is something pretty as well. It kind of reminds me of, say, like almost like Navajo pottery or something like that, almost.
Yeah, and I lost the photos of it because of a hard drive crash, but we caught this one that was like a bright creamsicle orange, and then it had those jet black, you know, two stripes into the H patterns and stuff like that.
Something
Like it
like
was,
that.
yeah,
Yeah,
and
they're
those
gorgeous.
blue eyes, like they're beautiful snakes, like, and they're, like I said, they're a pleasure to work with because most of the stuff that, you know, if you work with wild snakes in any capacity, like you're getting bitten, you're getting musked, they're defecating all over you. And
Doing
well,
snake stuff.
what's funny is they have more of a reason to be ornery since they have that specific species of tick that's on their tails, that feeds on their tail tip. It's crazy.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. Like, it was so rare to find a Bogertophus that had like an intact tail because of all the tick depredation, if you will, of them.
Yeah, clear example of ectoparasitism in a snake, as clear as day. But yeah, I mean, I guess what was probably the biggest one you yourself have seen personally?
Yeah, so I don't know if it may have been surpassed since. I don't remember the exact length of it, but I did catch the biggest one on the property during our window there. And it was a hair under 5 feet long.
Hair under 5, you said? Okay.
But it was just like, I mean, we there's a prim only a primitive road system in the research station, and so we would drive ATVs around, and I was just coming back to headquarters, and it was just like stretched almost across the entire road, like, and like all the others, it was like a sweetheart, just like picked it up, put it in the bag, and took it to measure it, then let it go.
That's so cool. It's so cool. I'm curious, Nate, if you have any other questions for James and
Yeah.
Northern Chihuahua, go for it.
I was
'Cause I
gonna
do
say,
want to transition to RGV.
is that research station, is that inside or outside of bear tri-snake range?
Outside.
Okay.
So it's west. So it's the far southeastern corner of Hudspeth County, right on the Rio Grande.
Okay, so very well into the panhandle then.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah. A little too far out west for bears,
Yeah.
so.
Well, you know, maybe before we transition to some of your RGV work, what are some other colubrids? Am I missing anything when it comes to the Northern Chihuahua? What other
So
colubrids that are
my personal favorites on the property, just because I'm kind of fascinated by the desert adaptations and just a few species of this tropical genus, but Trimorphodon. I love
Liar
Trimorphodon.
snakes.
Liar
I knew it.
fire.
Yeah. And so, liar snakes were another one of those things that were really poorly represented in capture data sets at the Indio Mountains. They'd also only found two of those. prior to my workout there. And I think in 4 years out there, I ended up catching like 28,
Whoa.
something like
Okay.
that. Is either 24 or 28. But it was basically like I just figured out that when it's cool and wet, just go high, just climb a mountain, and you're probably going to find a Trimorphodon. And so, but yeah, they're so cool.
So you got Bogrodophis, you got Alterna, and then now you have Trimorphodon. I guess with Trimorphodon, how are you seeing them? You said you're seeing them on cliff sides, climbing. And then how big are we talking? Because they're not really a big species of lyre snake, right?
Texas lyre snakes get pretty big. So,
Okay.
a typical adult female is going to be around, a meter, so 3 feet, give or
Oh,
take.
sizable. Okay.
Male's a little bit smaller. But I caught like all size classes represented, and you'd find them on vertical cliff faces, much like people who've shined for Alterna on roadside cuts find them. Seems like prior to like in the early 1900s, the Indio Mountains were subject to a lot of mining exploration. So there's like abandoned mine shafts and stuff like that. So you would see them crawling up kind of the vertical shafts or waiting on the vertical faces of the mine entrance for like bat emergences and stuff like that.
That's so cool.
Which
Yeah,
I never got to witness a predation event, but I was always just like,
the
think
main
that
reason
was
I bring the main reason I bring it up is since they partition with these other desert adaptive colubrids, I would just assume that maybe they seem to be more of a they have a saurian diet, or am I kind of off base with that?
Yeah, I think most of the literature would suggest that they eat mostly lizards and stuff like that. They're plucking them out of crevices and stuff like that at night. I think locally, it's pretty well documented that some of them will feed on a lot of bats, like I just mentioned. But they also, I know in captivity, they don't hesitate to take mice and stuff like that as well. So I think they're pretty generalist, but I think they probably, just based on where they're found, they're probably eating mostly lizards.
What underrated genera though? They're even in the literature, I feel like there's still not much known about them as a whole.
I still sometimes think about that lyre snake I saw in Costa Rica.
Dude, that thing was huge. That was like
That was a big one too. It
so
was
big.
probably
What
salt.
species was it?
It's the Central American lyre
Bisque.
snake, which
I think it's
is.
Bisquotas, something like that.
Okay.
I'll just go ahead and look it up. So if I interrupt you randomly, you'll know why. But
Bisquotas, something like that.
yeah, Biscuitatus.
I don't think it was that, but let's see here.
Know the
Because that's
Sonoran
what.
is in Lambda, Texas.
Because tau is really big in Mexico. They get
Yeah.
pretty big.
Again, that I think they definitely need to be reworked in the near future for sure.
It's a quadruplex is what it has listed on
Oh,
INET.
okay.
Okay.
Not familiar with that one. Cool though. Yeah, an underrated genre. I just wanted to bring that up. Now, if we're done with when they
I'll just randomly to keep you from talking about the RGV night snakes.
Oh, darn you. Okay. I mean, I love Hypsiglina too, so. So good.
I'm guessing night snakes were not that hard to find out there.
And so we actually had like just a little joke on the research station that, if you came across Hypsiglina or Coleonyx, it was time to call it a night, because just anecdotally, it seemed like once you started seeing the night snakes, everything else that was less common was pretty much shut down. And so, of course, it's just an anecdotal thing. I have no idea if there's
No, I
any data.
mean, anecdotal still worth its weight. I mean, I'm the same here in the Midwest. Whenever I start seeing just race runners, I know it's typically going to be probably a frustrating day of herping. I probably won't see much besides maybe a glance at a racer. So, there's definitely valor and anecdotal evidence. I guess maybe I don't want to take over for your question, Nate, but with Hypsiglina, I mean, did you see different variations in, I guess, color palette, or just, what was your overall
Not really. It's pretty
overview?
standard there, and we're also kind of limited in what kind of research ecologically we can do with
Sure,
Hypsiglina, just
sure.
because they're such small body size snakes.
Yeah.
And so
Be pretty difficult to
it's
put a tracker on them.
yeah. You could now with some of these Bluetooth trackers that are coming out that are like 0.3 grams, but
It's getting crazy out here.
yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, so there's some promising stuff for small snakes in the future, but no, those like it was basically just, we do our best for mark recapture stuff. Like we catch anything, measure it, mark it and stuff, but you're not gonna recapture a Hypsiglina. I think like before I got there, one of the coolest pictures I've ever seen was the individual who did the rock rattlesnake telemetry, Dr. Mata, and which he still works at UTEP. But he caught one of his transmitted rock rattlesnakes eating a Hypsiglina when he was out there tracking it. So it was a really cool like predation
The
note.
Lepidus, or what kind of rattlesnake?
Yeah, Lepidus.
Oh, wow.
So
Lepidus are a bit more prone to saurian diet anyways, so it
Yeah,
makes a little bit more sense. Yeah.
it's not a major jump, but that's pretty cool. That's a cool observe for sure.
Yeah.
Wow. I think with that, I do now think,
Pituophis. I'm joking.
hey, I think it'd be nice to just transition over a little bit and exploring your history with the RGV. So I think you mentioned beforehand you were down there in Thorn Scrub Country for a little bit for
Yeah, for a summer before going to UTEP,
yeah.
working on that
Maybe
mineral development.
talk about that, and maybe, I guess, present day excursions you've had in the RGV and.
Yeah, so prior to last year, the last, or prior to earlier this year, actually, the last time I was in RGV and kind of that Tamalipa and Thorn Scrub ecosystem was summer of 2013, which I lived down there at Chaparral Wildlife Management Area. One of the issues with a lot of public properties is the entities that manage those properties don't own subsurface rights to the properties. And so that's the case with a lot of Texas properties. And so I can't remember the exact number, but the there was a private ranch across the highway from Chaparral, and they leased the mineral rights for oil and gas exploration for 10 years for like $1 billion back then. And so the holders of the subsurface rights underneath Chaparral, we're like, okay, we need to get our slice of the pie while it's still, hot. And so we have this unique situation where you have this public wildlife research and demonstration area that is now going to be subjected to mineral and gas exploration. So how is that going to impact the biotic community as a whole? And so at the time, there are four state threatened herp species on the property: Texas indigo snakes, Texas horned lizards, Texas tortoises, and reticulated collared lizards. And so I think, I can't remember, I think Texas indigos have since been removed from state threatened status. So we wanted to look at how increases of traffic, habitat alteration from drill sites was going to impact these populations. So we kind of laid out a trapping study design. And so it was designed for ma two master's students to eventually take it over, and that would be their thesis research. But because of like hangups in the funding process, they couldn't get master's students to initially get it started in that summer of 2013. And so I needed money because I was moving to El Paso. And so I was a grad student that was just hired just for that summer to go down there, build and install traps, and kind of get it up and running so somebody else could take it over the
And what were
following
they?
year.
Were they drift fences or bucket traps? What?
Yeah, so they're big, large box traps. So basically, you take, your standard sheet of plywood, 8 by 4 feet, just like rip it and cross cut it in half and make a 4 by 4 foot trap, wrap it in hardware cloth, put a funnel on each side, and then a drift fence off of each funnel. Then at the ends of each drift fence, you put your pitfall traps. And so, we installed a lot. I can't even remember the number, but it was like 60 of those, and like lugging those giant things covered in like metal mesh through the Tamblethan thorn scrub was a chore, to say the least. So we put those out. It was actually an interesting summer for a lot of reasons, but they were in a big drought pre-2013 down there, and that's the summer the drought broke. And so we ended up catching like a bunch of Mexican milk snakes and stuff like that. And so it was a fun summer overall, but there were kind of ebbs and flows of like funding related to the project and everything. So in terms of actually running smoothly as a research project, had its hiccups, but it was a fun summer nonetheless. And then I didn't get out there until I took a spring break field trip earlier this year back to the far south tip of Texas for
And also, James, but that first endeavor back in 2013, mixing milk snakes, did you also get your hands at, Mexican racers and indigos or?
So this site is north of speckled racer territory, and so it's on the boundary of Dimmit and LaSalle County, so kind of in between San Antonio and Laredo. So little far north, but a lot of Texas tortoises,
Nice.
a lot of indigo snakes there. The atrox are giant there, so it's kind of fun to catch the atrox there.
That's another thing too that should be looked at because, obviously Atrox has a huge range in the nation, but it seems like, South Texas produces like the biggest and baddest ones.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's just, growing season related, but because they can basically be active. Like if you go all the way south to like Brownsville down there, they can be active all year if they want to.
Yeah, that's awesome. So yeah, my bad. So maybe bring us up to date. Like you said, spring of 2023.
Of 25, so this year. So that was my first time back to kind of Tamalipan thorn scrub country, and
Awesome.
but this time I was on the other side of the coin because it was me taking my students down there, and
Oh,
not me
okay.
as the student going down there. And so weather didn't really cooperate for herps, but we still managed to turn up several indigo snakes, no tortoises though, it was still nice to get back down there. So we went to Laguna Atascosa National Wildlife Refuge for that stuff. They also have black spotted newts down there, and I was kind of bummed didn't get to see any of those because it had been since 2013 since I'd seen those. So
What's the overview on those guys? Yeah, kind of give us a little bit of an overview because it's kind of strange for them to be down there. Just like they're a very unique newt species.
Yeah, and so we have the wide-ranging, eastern newts that get into most of Texas, but then on this lower to mid Texas coast, you have this swath of black spotted newts, and they're a state threatened species, and it's kind of just interesting distributionally. I'm not well enough versed in like their evolutionary history to kind of speculate on what's going on with them distributionally, but they're cool species. And one of the properties that I work at now, it would be a slight range extension for them, but other researchers have gotten environmental DNA hits on them, but we haven't actually been able to turn up an actual newt, which you have to find the animal itself needs more than eDNA.
Yeah, it just seems like they're one of those species that, even though the RGV is relatively high in moisture, depending on the time of the season, they seem to be more of a dry adapted type of new, estivating when it's when conditions are bad and then coming back up when, rains come.
Yeah, so I've seen them in dry conditions and wet conditions when I was down there as an undergrad and a grad student. Like you can flip them under completely dry rocks, and you just have these little wrinkly newts. It seems like it's a miserable existence for a newt, but they seem to do fine.
Yeah, that's so foreign.
And then, you can, if you find a breeding pond or whatever, you can hit pay dirt. I think in one seine haul, we hit just the right breeding pond, and one seine haul, we caught like 72 once. And so we're just collecting genetic samples from them. So
Really cool.
it
What
was
about
a,
the oh, my bad, go on.
oh no, it was just a memorable seine haul. Like I'll never forget like those things.
Yeah, what about the Mexican burrowing frogs? Do you have any luck seeing those?
I have not been for them. I want to, but they're so like where I'm at now, if you want to see them, you basically have to be able to, in those counties, when the rain hits, you just got to drop everything and take the 5-hour drive and go see them. And I haven't been able to line up my availability with, when that South Texas hurricane fallout rain hits.
Yeah, I mean they're a real boom bust kind of a critter.
I know plenty of people who just like are just like, okay, calling off work tomorrow, heading on out. And because they're so cool, like their calls and their goofy heads and fat bodies and bright orange stripes, they're cool species.
They are awesome. That's so cool. Well, I mean, maybe regale us a little bit more. So on this recent trip, obviously you brought students and you guys kind of hit it all right. What about the reticulated collar lizard? Have you ever had any luck with those?
I've only found one.
Okay.
And so there's
I guess also what's the
on
deal with those guys? Are they like you said they're an endangered type of collared in
yeah,
Texas?
so they're kind of like a in terms of their US range, I'm not sure if they get into Mexico or not, but they're endemic to kind of that Tamalitan thorn scrub habitat. And I've heard there's certain, but they follow like the rocky veins through it, which are relatively limited microhabitats through that ecosystem. And so, like the first time I was looking for them, we found one on one of our field trips when I was an undergrad, and we just like got lucky, and it was a cold day, and we stepped out of a van, and the first rock this girl flipped, there was a reticulated collared lizard under it. But that's the only one I've ever seen. And I've been looking for them like ever since. I've heard like on some of the private ranches they can be relatively common, but of course you have to secure proper access to those.
Yeah, and there's one thing Texas ranchers won't do, it's give scientists access to look for state protected species on their property.
It's hard to find that. I'm
It's like,
actually finding like
hey, you want to come on my property, find something, and then basically give the state the casus belli to seize my land.
not on my watch.
But yeah, like I mean it's so variable with landowners in Texas. Like my current like timber rattlesnake study site, like there is like some of the neighboring landowners are like cool with our snakes, and if they leave the property, they're like, yeah, come on over. And others are just like, don't come over here. Like, we don't want you here. And I'm gonna kill your snakes.
Sounds
So
about
it's just
right.
super variable. It's just luck of the draw with them.
Well, maybe we can start winding down with that timber project you're talking about. So what's and tell us with that. What's going on with that?
Yeah, so I kind of like fortuitously kind of fell into this project like face first. And so my position at Texas State emphasizes teaching. And so the majority of my appointment is related to teaching, so and advising students as program director. And so despite that, I still wanted to remain research active because most of us get into this stuff because the field work's what we love. And so I was kind of exploring opportunities, and there's an established old school herpetologist on the site or at the university, and I was kind of like, well, should I approach him? Because he has a bit of a reputation throughout Texas of being difficult to work with. And so started talking with him, and he has some interesting population genetics data in this population of timber rattlesnakes. And he was like, this is our data, this is how we're interpreting it. I need a behavioral ecologist to validate our interpretations. And so basically it's northwest of Houston, kind of if you're familiar with Lake Conroe area.
I've heard of it.
It's okay, so it's like 10 miles south of Lake Conroe. It's a private property. It is run by a nonprofit, the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation, who support stewardship on private lands in Texas. And this is their flagship property. They've won like the highest stewardship awards in Texas for what they do with like management and repatriation of like shortleaf pine and recovery of red-cockaded woodpeckers and stuff like that. And so, but this property's, you know, an 11,000 acre postage stamp in a rapidly urbanizing part of Texas. And so all that Houston spillover is spreading out towards Conroe. And so it's like you can look at Google Earth like over time and you can just see the encroachment. So with the population genetics data, he found a couple of interesting things. And so the population is structured into two haplotypes. So we basically have two different genetic lineages on the property. One that most matches snakes from like 100 miles away, and then one that is just unique to that property. When we look at the more common property-specific haplotypes and we look at allelic diversity, so heterozygosity measures, they resemble the heterozygosity structures that we see in the communal denning northeast populations, which it's been variable as to how southern populations of hordes overwinter, whether communally or whatsoever. And so he was basically like, look, this data tells us that they're dinning communally, but we need confirmation that they are. And so he was like, I have funding, I'll buy you transmitters. I just need somebody to validate this stuff. And so I was like, funding's biggest hurdle, I'm on board. And turns out he's been great to work with. So he's been very supportive of me throughout the process. And like first winter, right off the bat, like boom, we started catching like communal dens. And so it was like, okay, this is cool stuff. This is, showing us, validating our hypotheses, based or supporting our hypotheses, and so, which is always exciting. And so, since then, the project has kind of begun to snowball. So now we have a couple of master's students that I'll be mentoring, kind of coming in on the project and expanding it. And because, I mean, aside from this, we know nothing about what Texas hortus do. There've been a couple of small studies like back in the 70s and 80s, but nothing in the kind of depth that we're doing. And so, when you factor in that they were one of those species where state protections were removed a few years ago, we're going to see kind of attempt to see if that removal was warranted or what's going on, because even though we don't have the data either way, their range in Texas just happens to overlap some of the most rapidly developing parts of Texas. And so we suspect that they might actually be in a bit of trouble. So, as timber rattlesnake populations throughout the range, it's also really cool because you have this super wide-ranging species, and in certain parts of its range, different populations act similarly, and in other parts they act differently. And so it's really cool to finally start to contribute what Texas snakes are doing to that equation. And so, like, our snakes seem to be overwintering in situations very similar to those snakes in the New Jersey Pine Barrens. And so they're denning communally, they're denning in eroded root holes along waterways. One of our dens was flooded throughout a couple of weeks of the winter, and which, they documented those dens getting flooded in New Jersey and stuff like that. So, pretty cool to see populations separated by so many miles just behaving this similar way.
So what you're saying is even when these dens are flooded, the snakes are still there, and they just tolerate, or they just deal with being flooded out, or
Yeah, so we don't know the internal structure of the dens, of course. So they're gonna have to have, places to at least keep their heads above water so they can breathe. But the first master student coming in, what he is going to look at doing is characterizing the denning environment. So he's going to look at extent and structure and internal environment. And he's going to try to find areas or holes that look similar outside but are unoccupied, so we can see if there are any key differences between occupied and unoccupied sites. And then once we can get a grasp on what they're using to select these areas, he's going to quantify availability to see if, like, in a lot of those northeastern populations, den sites have been found to be limiting for those populations. And so to see if we have any issues with den availability and stuff like that. So it's kind of cool stuff. And also, just like anecdotally, like, we're out there, I was out there yesterday, tracking snakes, and one of our males and female that bred last year, and then the female had babies this year, early this year, we lost the mail. We don't know if we had like transmitter failure or if he just moved too far and we lost the signal. But this week, he was miraculously like back in the same vicinity as the female, and he had broken his rattle off, so he no longer had his transmitter. And they're just a couple of hundred feet away from the same den that they used last year. So, interesting stuff. Like, his rattle now is too small for us to put another transmitter on, but I really wish we could so we could know for sure if they're denning together again.
So,
Awesome.
not to throw a firebrand in, but where do you land on the canebrake debate?
So I'm not sure. I haven't read the paper that did away with it. I know Rulon Clark's work, and he does good work. And so, but I haven't read that specific paper. The thing that I don't like about it is the fact that, like, the state that I'm in used the sinking of Atrocodatus as a reason to justify removing them from being state protected. And so being state protected wasn't based on any, or removal from state protections wasn't based on any biological data. It was based on just the fact that, oh, this thing's found in the eastern two-thirds of the US, so it's doing fine. And so it's basically just like, this is a way to get rid of a headache. And I am of the impersonation, or of the impression, that whether we're gonna manipulate protections, what we do needs to be biologically justified. So it may not need protection in Texas, but we need the biological data to show that. And so that's the problem with so many of our herp species, is we don't have that underlying biological data to inform meaningful, management objectives.
Exciting stuff. Yeah, I can't wait for when everything's going to be published on this, because yeah, it always seemed like timbers in Texas always kind of had a spotty, or I mean, I'm not too sure. Is their distribution relatively spotty, or how are they set up in Texas?
Yeah, so it's pretty spotty. You have some kind of weird fingers coming in from the north, from Oklahoma, where you get, just north of Fort Worth, you get some like fingers of forest coming in. But I would say their most kind of reliable distribution in Texas is southeastern Texas, where you get that good mixed pine forest ecosystem, which is, shortleaf, longleaf, loblolly pine, and then a mixture of various hardwood types. Which that southeastern chunk is where all of that development is, as Houston just like kind of grows uncontrollably.
It's raw, it's widespread, yeah.
And then you get people that are in Houston because of like job opportunities, but they don't want to live around all those people, so they move out to places like Conroe and Montgomery and stuff like that, and those areas get developed. And so yeah, it's kind of spotty. And then you have like the westernmost population is actually just like 20 minutes away from my house here. And so you get just a little bit southeast of San Antonio. And historically, there's some records that suggest that it actually follow like the San Marcos River and Guadalupe River up further north, but they've been extirpated in most of those more western counties now. And so
Sure.
just a like 20 minutes to the south or to the east of me here is where their westernmost extant population is. That's reliable. So, but there, once you get on the western boundary, they're heavily tied to those riverways.
Sure,
Makes sense.
big
They probably,
snake
probably
may
like that
want.
moisture a little bit more than the more Western species.
Yeah. And I have seen in that westernmost population, I have found them and Aatrox about a quarter of a mile away from one another. So I'm just like, I wonder if any hybrids are going to turn up here.
That'd be really neat. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, did you have any other questions to shoot off, Nate?
Where can people find you online?
So online on the only social media that I still have active is Instagram, and it is my Instagram handle is a little unfamiliar to a lot of people. It's Yovo underscore Adewoato, which is Adehoatoo, which that's kind of an inside joke between my fiance and myself. And so she is from West Africa. And so she's from Togo. And so she would call me that when she first found out that I worked with venomous snakes, but I didn't know what it meant, of course. But it turns out Yovo means white guy and Adewoato means crazy. And so she would call me crazy white guy for working with venomous snakes. And so
Hilarious.
turned it into my handle. So,
Yeah. Great. And also, yeah, I would recommend Ramblers. Check out his page. Awesome photography, man. You definitely know how to work a camera.
appreciate it. I've been so busy this year. I haven't posted much in a while, but
But it'll always be there. I mean, I'm the same way. I didn't really do too much this year, but it'll
yeah.
always be there. I have to ask, since you said your wife is from Togo. Do you have any plans to visit Africa at all, or?
Oh, I can't wait. Like we haven't had the I haven't had the financial means to get over there,
Sure.
but back when I was keeping stuff, I had like some Gaboon vipers and rhino vipers from Togo.
Oh,
So
okay.
I was just like,
Hard if yeah.
I need to get over there and find them for myself in the wild.
Yeah.
Okay, well, maybe that kind of leads us into like one of our final questions. You can take it off, Nate, if
Yeah,
you don't mind.
so what's one place in the world or in the United States that you haven't gone herping to before that you most want to go herping to?
Okay, so that's a tough one. Like
Save the best for last.
two things like come to mind. So even though I'm a venomous snake person in terms of what most of my herp career has been built on, my favorite herp family is Varanidae. I've always been
Nice.
obsessed with monitor lizards. I almost actually did a PhD project through UT Arlington working with monitor lizards in Sumatra and Java, but it was going to be more phylogenetic based, and I wanted to stay in ecology. So ultimately, I chose to go to UTEP. But with monitors in mind, it's like a bucket list thing for me to see Komodo dragons in the wild. And so that's a pretty easy one. If I had to do snakes, it would be spider-tailed vipers in the wild. So
Okay.
either Komodo or Iran.
So
What a
very different
contrast. Yeah.
areas, but spider-tailed vipers are just like on paper probably the one snake that I really want to see more than any other snake. But there's so many cool things, and I really, one of the things that doing a PhD and being tied to research, especially with radio telemetry, where you have to be really present, is it reduces the amount of time that I've had to travel internationally. And so because I got to be out there like every Friday getting my relocation to all my snakes and stuff like that. And so, one of these days when things settle down, like I really need to spread my wings internationally. Because one of the cool things about like Nate's page that I've seen is like, you know, those nice geophis and stuff from Costa Rica
It's
and
not just my page, it's also Brian's as well.
Well, no, man, but you still that Costa Rica trip, you had some phenomenal shots too, and some great critters you guys found, you know.
And so
Yeah,
I
well,
mean
let me gush on Oaxaca a little bit for you while we're on it.
the my
The
second home. Guy who did the still works at UTEP and does the rock rattlesnake telemetry and stuff out there. He is from Oaxaca.
Small world. Wow.
So Dr. Vicente Matasilva. And
Okay.
so if you looked at Oaxacan distributional records, you probably run across his name.
Okay. Yeah, maybe. Sounds familiar. That's awesome. That's cool. Dude. Yeah. I can't rep Oaxaca enough for sure. So, but I mean, great answer with either seeing Komodos or seeing, you
Spider
know,
tails.
Iranian spider-tailed vipers, you
I
know.
mean, there's so much cool herp diversity. Like, you can't go wrong with
No.
anywhere. And so,
No.
like, if you have an opportunity to travel somewhere, you should do it.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Awesome.
And with that, I think we'll end it out here. Again, thanks, James, for coming on the show. And once again, thanks for Bryant for helping to co-host the show.
Co-host
Be
as always. Yep.
sure to check out Serpentine Expeditions. Once again, use code CK25 at checkout for $100 off your herp tour. And with that, I'll bid you all adieu.